So we're reading from Canto 4, Chapter 11, Text 6. Tam hanyamana mavibhiksha guyakan. Anagatas chitra ratena buddhisha. Utanupadim kripaya pitamaho. Manu jagato pagata sahasibi. Those yakshas. Hanyamanam. Being killed. Abhiviksha. Seen. Guyakan. The yakshas. Anagatas. Offenseless. Chitra Ratena. By Dhruva Maharaj, who had a beautiful chariot. Buddhisha. Greatly. Uttanupadim. Unto the son of Uttanupad. Kripaya. Out of mercy. Pitamaha. The grandfather. Manu. Swayambhuva Manu. Jagada. Gave instruction. Upagata. Approached. Sahasribi. With the great sages. Translation. When Swayambhuva Manu saw that his grandson Dhruva Maharaj was killing so many of the yakshas who were not actually offenders, out of his great compassion, he approached Dhruva with the great sages to give him good instruction. Please repeat. When Swayambhuva Manu saw that his grandson, Dhruva Maharaj, was killing so many of the yakshas who were not actually offenders, out of his great compassion, he approached Dhruva with great sages to give him good instruction. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Dhruva Maharaj attacked Alakapuri, the city of the yakshas, because his brother was killed by one of them. Actually, only one of the citizens, not all of them, was guilty of killing his brother, Uttam. Dhruva Maharaj, of course, took a very serious step when his brother was killed by the yakshas. War was declared and the fighting was going on. This sometimes happens in present day also. For one man's fault, a whole state is sometimes attacked. This kind of wholesale attack is not approved by Manu, the father and lawgiver of the human race. He therefore wanted to stop his grandson Dhruva from continuing to kill the yaksha citizens who were not offenders. Omakyanati mahandasya kinagyana salakaya chakshu unmilitam jena tasmai shri guruvay namaha. So there are five chapters dedicated to the glorious life and activities of Dhruva Maharaj. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu used to constantly listen to two particular Katas. Do you know what they were? Dhruva Maharaj and Prahlad Maharaj. So there's something very exceptional in these two pastimes. And I think it has a lot to do with the tender age of these two boys. That both of them were coming from Kshatriya backgrounds, and therefore they were strong and fearless. Does anyone know the two characteristics of a Kshatriya?
Courage in battle.
Courage in battle, yes. Not quite the two, but yes. Yes, yes, similarly, yes. The first one is he cannot tolerate insults or dishonor. Can't tolerate that. It's impossible for him to tolerate that. And the second one is he will never back down from a challenge. So in today's day and age, where all of this culture has deteriorated under the influence of time and under the influence of Kali, Hare Krishna. We see that people like that are revolting. But honestly, they can't handle it if anyone doesn't praise them, and they, if you say, do you want to fight, they'll destroy you ruthlessly. We see people like this, they're dictators. Or they're quite terrifying people. They have some sort of a narcissistic sense that their rights are beyond everybody else's right, even to live. But the Kshatriya spirit, although it was based on these two things, I don't tolerate any insult to my role, to my position of responsibility, and I won't back down from a fight. When these two things came in contact with saintliness, not that every Kshatriya king was saintly, but the ruling system was like that, but when these two things contacted also saintliness, then you had an amazing experience. I remember sometimes, long, long years ago, when I would get a little bit agitated about the circumstances of the day and age in which we live, some injustice or some abominably selfish thing that was going on in the name of good government, I would remember Dhruva Maharaj and I would think to myself, oh, if only I had been born in that time, because it would be so amazing to have a king who was so bold, so chivalrous, so righteous, and took it as his main duty to take care of his citizens. I would think, just imagine, and he lived for 36,000 years. It would have been so wonderful to have a king like this. Sometimes I would think, Srila Prabhupada keeps telling us about these righteous Vedic kings, but where do we see such a thing now? In fact, we see totally exactly the opposite. We need not go into it because it's so dark and deep, how ambitious and greedy and sinful the leadership of the world is today. It takes your breath away sometimes when you see what people are daring to do in the disguise of leadership. But here, in the example of Dhruva Maharaj, he had that strong spirit, and if he didn't have that strong spirit, he would never have gone away to the forest and taken the vows that he took. He did something so extraordinary. In 6 months, he covered what we would cover in probably 600 lifetimes, if we were lucky. He was so focused. And actually Narada Muni specifically wanted to help him because he knew he comes in the line of Swayambhuva Manu. And Manu is such an exalted personality. He's the lawgiver of mankind. That means that his laws give the proper behavior for people to follow. Of course, today, in today's day and age, this seems like a fairy story, so far away from where we are now. But when we read or hear about Dhruva Maharaj, or these other saintly kings, if we're listening attentively, it gives a feeling in the heart how wonderful that would be to have a righteous leader. And not a weak righteous leader, a pacifistic righteous leader, but a righteous leader who would stand up and fight and kill if necessary to protect the standards of civilized life for his citizens and for the world. So we almost can see, if we draw our attention to this point, that the world is almost crying as a result of not having that. Instead, you have a darkness that goes around, and within the darkness, just like if you come into, if you came in by very good chance, good fortune, and you were a thief, if you had a key and you made your way into one of these big shopping malls at night, no one's around, no lights are on, in the darkness, what would a thief do? What would they do? What do you think they would do? In the darkness, alone in a shopping mall.
Steal.
And what would they do? They would steal as much as they could fit in their pockets. Right? And they would be going around like this, looking in the dark. What else is there? Well, here's this. What was over there? Yes, that. I can take that. They would just be completely thinking, what good fortune this is for me. And I'll get out of here. Perhaps I have gloves on even to make sure they don't get my fingerprints. Mm-hmm. And I just take as much as I can. And as much as I can take is mine. So this is the modern world's mindset. This is what the university, the city of the universe, it encourages all the young people, come in, welcome, take your education. It's compulsory now because it's an education in which we're making a huge amount of profit. So it's a business, it's an education industry. So come in and learn from us in one way or another how you can get into the shopping mall in the dark of night and take as much as you can. You can take as much as you can from this world and call it all yours. And once it's yours, then you can do anything you want with it. So this is one of the characteristics of Kali Yuga, and there are many, many more that cause the heart to feel some pain. Because if we just stop and think for a moment, these ideal qualities are what actually brings joy to one's life. And the happiness you get from grabbing all of those things, a few more mobile phones, 10 or 12, and sticking them in your big pockets, it's filled with tension and suspicion and anxiety and worries and trying to make sure nobody saw me and how can I... It's filled with a lot of duplicity. And that duplicity creates a fever in the mind, in the heart. And one moves under the influence of that feverish condition and circulates around trying to get done whatever one can in the way of stealing. And where is the happiness there? Because you can never put down your guard and relax because someone may come along and question why you have 10 mobile phones. I agree, but why do you have 10 mobile phones? Where did you get them all? And they might ask you a question, so you have to have a plan. What you'll say when you say, oh, my auntie gave them all to me. And you work it all out, so you're all the time working out how I can get away with it. And this is how you look at, if you look at the people of this world, they're so disturbed. They look very fashionable, they look very confident, but if you look a little bit closely, you'll see that they're very disturbed. They're confident but very disturbed, because they're holding on to something that is not actually theirs. And so Kali Yuga means this must increase and increase and increase and rebound and affect everybody in so many different ways. So when we hear from the Bhagavatam, we hear from somebody who's so exalted, we hear about somebody who's so exalted, and what that does is it kind of coats our heart for a moment with a feeling that, how wonderful. Imagine if my children took after a person like that. A person, yes, who won't stand down from a fight and who won't allow anyone to disrespect them, but who is righteous and pure. How wonderful for our children to think of a role model like that. However, in Kali Yuga, it's not so simple, because the atmosphere around us is surcharged with a different kind of energy. Nevertheless, we take our daily dose of the Bhagavatam. And for those who are even more fortunate, they take more than just a daily dose. They think more of the Bhagavatam throughout the day, and they try to live their lives aligned with higher principles. And for such people, it is said that even though Kali Yuga is so impossibly, hopelessly, negatively geared, that means that if you win, you lose, and if you lose, you lose, because either way, you incur so much sinful reactions in what you're doing, that your next life is guaranteed to be also in the same track. So with this situation, to hear the Bhagavatam, it takes one as if up to the top of a very high hill or mountain. Just like I would think it would be so nice to live in the time of Dhruva Maharaj, when I would read the Bhagavatam, and that would somehow or another insulate me against all the things I saw around me that seemed inevitable and overpowering. And right now, we have just heard in such an interesting description about what Dhruva Maharaj went through. At first he heard a deafening sound like the ocean. If you have ever, I don't think any of you have ever seen a tidal wave. But one time I looked on YouTube because I wanted to picture in my mind what a tidal wave would be like. That's an ocean wave that's taller than this building. And even though it only momentarily comes crashing down, because the water again settles down and just becomes deep water, the effect of it is that it smashes all the windows in the building, it pushes out all the trees in the garden, it knocks over and destroys everything. Because it's like a fierce wall of water that's coming towards you with the force of a great aeroplane. It's forcing itself towards you, and there you are, and there it is. And the first thing that Dhruva Maharaj saw and heard was the sound like that of the ocean, almost deafening. And then the yakshas, because after all he had come to attack them, they defended themselves with other mystical visions to defeat him. And he saw there was a huge thunderstorm and there was lightning flashing. Has anyone ever been in a situation where they've had a lightning almost overhead? Yes? Was it scary? Yes? Was the sound of the thunder very loud? Yes, if the lightning is right overhead, there's only a second between the sound of the thunder and the lightning. However many seconds there are, that's how many kilometers or miles or distance away the lightning is. But to have the thunder crash and the lightning come, especially if the lightning hits your house and electrifies everything, So Dhruva Maharaj is one man against 130,000 yakshas. And there he is with his charioteer on his chariot, so powerful. And then this lightning comes, and the lightning flash comes. And then rain starts pouring down. And then not only rain, but filthy things come falling down. Like disgusting things start falling out of the air all around. You would want to run away. And then dead bodies fall down. You'd be going, oh, look at this. This is so horrible, so loathsome. And still they continued. And then snakes came down. And then a mountain. Just imagine another one. If there was a huge mountain and you see a rock some mile away even, and it's rolling down the mountain, this huge rock, and it's coming right towards you. And if you would, you would run, except that you've got something behind you and on each side, and you're in your chariot, and here comes this mountain rock crashing down on you. So one time I asked a studious devotee, could those things, the rocks, the ocean, the lightning, the elephants and snakes that he saw next, and so forth, could any of them have actually killed him? Was there a real snake, a real lion, tiger, and so forth? And this scholarly devotee said, no, they were illusions, but they could terrify him. And you can also die of horror. Right? Something can be so frightening that someone has a heart attack and they faint on the ground. You know, I heard a story about this. When I was in India, not last year, the year before, and they demonetized. Yes. And all of a sudden, the 500 rupee note was worth nothing. I heard a story, it may have been a rumor, but there was a gentleman living across the road from a big sweet shop on the main road of Vrindavan. And according to the story, he had under his bed, you know those Indian beds that lift up and you put the mattress underneath? He had under two beds in his house 500 rupee notes stacked up like this. He had so much illegal money. And when he heard that all of this money, anyone from India can picture how many notes that is, under a whole bed this high, stacked up, that it was all worthless. In a second it was worthless. He had a heart attack. Because he places his value, that this is my power, this is my wealth, and suddenly fate has turned it around and now it's just valueless paper. And do you know people were taking paper like that and flushing it down the drains to get rid of it? Because not only was it worthless, but it was illegal. And if they were caught with it, they were in the greatest of trouble. And they had a choice. They could give it to the bank and make it legal. And then what would happen when you give all this stacks of notes to the bank? What will they say? Where did you get this from? Where did you get all that money from? So here they were. Here is Dhruva seeing all this, and it was actually terrifying. And so the devas appear, the demigods, because Dhruva Maharaj is such a great devotee. And they assure him. And what do they assure him? Does anyone remember what they tell him to do? No, they tell him something else. First. That then, yes. To remember the Lord and?
To chant,
yes. There's a wonderful verse where they say that the chanting of the holy name of the Lord, we find it. Where is the verse? Does anyone know offhand where that verse is?
It's the last verse of
yes. The holy name of the Lord is so powerful, is as powerful as the Lord himself. Therefore, simply by chanting and hearing the holy name of the Lord, Many men can be fully protected from fierce death without difficulty. That's amazing. Don't you ever ask yourself, as I do, how come I don't feel that? How come I don't live in that kind of vibrant confidence? How come I don't chant all the time, if that's the truth of the Holy Name? How come I go about my ordinary life like an ant who crawls up here and down there, and then who also crawls into the temple room but knows nothing of it, crawls up the deity's dress, even crawls across their lotus hands and crawls down again and keeps crawling on with a crumb to take home because that's what my duty is, and just crawls on unaware of where they've been? How come I don't feel it? Does anyone have a prescription for me? Or do you ask the same question? How come? Does it work? Does it really work? Are there conditions apply? And I can't apply because I don't have those, can't meet those conditions? So this is a very deep question, and perhaps it's a question that we should ask ourselves often. We shouldn't avoid this question. How come I don't feel it? But we should ask the question here. We should ask the question here to the deities. We shouldn't ask this question to our mind, because our mind will give you some sort of an answer. But the mind is already distracted, and so when you ask the question, such a deep question, to yourself, the answer will be something not very significantly helpful. But we need to ask this question, because there will come a time when we too will be standing in the face of death. We'll be standing there. It won't be Dhruva Maharaj, it will be ourselves. And what will we do then? So for a long time, we may tell ourselves, oh, that's a very uncomfortable thought. I don't think I can think about that right now. I'm very busy, and I do believe everything will be all right. And that's okay, except that if we are not making the effort to ask this question, how can my spiritual life become more real? How can I face the difficulties that I face with a faith that tries to penetrate into the mystery of what I'm going through, rather than just crumbles and grumbles? How can I have that kind of vitality? Because it's said that that's me. That's not kind of like something bestowed upon a person here and there of great quality. But that's actually me. I'm like that. So what is covering and distracting me from my own essence? So the Holy Name has the power to remove the things that are causing us to be afraid, that are causing us to lose our courage, and that are causing us to be mildly or excessively distracted by the things of this world that float by as if waves on a river. But Dhruva Maharaj regained his composure, he regained his strength, and he went into battle again. He defeated these illusions, but he continued on with his fight to a point that is considered to be, by his grandfather, too much. He had to stop. He couldn't go any further in his attempt to retaliate for the death of his brother. So we will hear more about this in the next few days, Swayambhuva Manu's instructions and how he guided Dhruva Maharaj and how Dhruva responded to his grandfather's request. And Srila Prabhupada will enlighten us also here about what it is that Swayambhuvamana was not satisfied with. He was going to destroy so many yakshas for the fault of one. This was too much. But interestingly enough, if you look back in this wonderful Bhagavatam Leela, you'll see that when Dhruva Maharaj went to the forest, one of his main motivating factors, you could say, was that he was a Kshatriya. He couldn't tolerate any disrespect or any lack of honor. And he couldn't back down from fighting, from a war. So with his Kshatriya spirit so strong, even as a young boy, he couldn't tolerate what his stepmother said to him. It was intolerable to him. And he saw his brother Uttam as his enemy. At that time, he was thinking, he's my enemy because he will get what I can't have. This was the immature Kshatriya spirit, it could be said. Or we could say that it is Dhruva Maharaj revealing gradually, uncovering gradually the exalted nature of a Vaishnava, but beginning from a point where we can relate and then going high, high, high above anything that we can imagine. So he was thinking that my brother is my enemy, and at this time he's thinking the Yakshas who killed my brother are my enemies. And Swayambhuvamana wants him to stop. So we'll hear more about this in days to come. So I will also stop here. Manu says, my dear son, please stop. So I will also stop. So if anyone has any thoughts on this particular pastime, I would be very happy to hear them. And if not, then we should all stop. We should stop our wandering minds from wandering away from Krishna. And we should try to revitalize regularly, daily, almost momentarily, our Krishna consciousness. Because we have the ability to do that. We may say, no, I don't. But I'll have to say, yes, you do. You're just not using it right. So revive a good habit. It's not impossible. Because as we become more enthusiastic, more alive in our own, in the relationship between our meditation on pleasing Krishna and our day-to-day activities, which may not harmonize, they may almost sometimes appear to be in conflict, but as we become more intent to do these two things in a balance together, then what happens is, the first thing that happens, does anyone know what's the first thing that happens? Yes?
We become peaceful.
No. We become peaceful? No. What's the first thing that happens? That comes later. Say again. That comes later. What happens first?
We see Krishna in our activities.
That comes later. What comes first?
The battle within the mind. Like the battle with the mind. The
battle. It's a battle with the mind. Yes. The first thing that happens is, yes, see, the ladies know more about these things. I guess they have a bigger battle. The first thing that will happen if you really try and do it, not just sort of an intellectual shift, is that you'll see that you can't do it. Because what will happen is, to whatever degree you're determined and focused in your day-by-day life right now, the mind will tell you, go back there. Why are you doing this? Do that. And then you'll say, no, no, I want to do this now. And the mind will say, no, 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 we can do this. And a battle will take place. And it's not an easy battle because the mind's habit is to mix two things together. It mixes the devotional things and the mundane things together. They're sort of some kind of a dough. And so when you think, okay, I'm going to do the devotional things and leave the others aside, you find that they're sort of glued together. And it's not so simple. So the first thing you realize is this is not so simple. And if you're very, very determined, then what can happen, or if you're not so determined, but you would like to improve, you start to feel helpless. You need help to do it. And you look around at other people, even other devotees, and they're valuable to help you. But because the core problem is core in the heart, and in the mind, deep, deep, deep embedded, they can only give you, you could say, they can give you advice from the outside, but they can't actually enter inside and understand even what exactly you're talking about. So they can tell you general principles. They can tell you what works for them. And if they're like you, when they tell you what works for them, it may very much help you. But the very specific nature of your predicament, the elaborate details of what your consciousness is like, only one other person can help you with that. Because there's one other person who knows. So Krishna says, I am seated in everyone's heart. From me comes knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. So he is situated there with us, but we don't perceive him there. Am I the only one who has that problem? I think not. It's a common problem, like a common cold, that we don't perceive him with us. And I find, as a practitioner of Krishna consciousness, that at my very best, I'm kind of controlling my mind and I'm getting myself to go in the right direction. And that I feel, then I feel some satisfaction. But sometimes I realize that I could do a lot more than that if I was plugged in to this relationship. If the connection was there, in the same way as I have a mobile phone and it has a battery and the battery runs down and at a certain part of rundownness doesn't work properly. But when I plug it into the wall and recharge it, as we all know, it does everything fine because it's plugged in. Electricity is coming from another source. It's not running on the battery. It's running on electricity that's being provided. And this is the great mystery of Krishna consciousness. I, according to my piety, my devotion, my purva samskar, I can do very well or not so well. But when I plug in, if I can learn the art of plugging into Krishna, that means to put my desire before Krishna, that please you use me, not me using me, you use me. When one gets that exalted intelligence, then one is no longer working on one's own strength. And you can watch it, like you can watch the phone. Now I can do everything, but it's plugged in. Problem is, nobody wants their mobile phone plugged in. It's contradictory to the idea of mobile, right? We used to all have phones plugged in. We didn't have mobile phones. So at least, at very least, let's recharge them every morning and then use that charge throughout the day and recharge again. It's coming from the source, and the source is capable of giving us unlimited strength. If we could understand our full capacity, we would be astonished and horrified at the level of our consciousness right now. Srila Prabhupada said, once I was listening to a lecture, and he said, you do not understand. You have capacity almost on the level of God. Almost on the level of God is your ability. And now, what are we doing? We're like the small sparks that have flown out of the fire and making our own little burning experience somewhere. But if we could learn this art, then like Dhruva Maharaj, who is fighting with so many yakshas, we too would be able to extend our capacity to almost on the level of God. That sounds too fantastic, doesn't it? We all have to go to work and do things and have children and they bother us and so many different things. It sounds fantastic. That is what the Bhagavatam has been given to us to help us to understand. Thank you. Yes,
Chandra. It was Dhruva Maharaj killing the citizens. That's why Manu Maharaj asked him to stop?
Yes, because he wanted to see Alakapuri. He wanted to see their capital. If you read back a few verses. So, in a sense, they were justified in sending all of this. In the battle, they fought together and he killed so many. Then they retreated. Then he wanted to have a look at their city. That meant killing them still. So he went towards the city. They provided their illusory experience. He was then awarded by the demigods the understanding how to proceed. And so he proceeded with his weapon to kill so many of them. Was it right or wrong? For a Kshatriya, that question doesn't arise. Because they have a different kind of character. It's sort of impossible for us to understand. Because we see such self-motivated, selfish leadership in the world today that if somebody is coming into the city and killing so many people, it's horrific. But if you examine closely, I think it's in one of the purports, it's explained, or maybe it's another section of the Bhagavatam, that all of those yakshas attained elevation to the beyond the sun planet because they were killed by such an exalted personality. Ah, good. Okay. Yes. Yes. So his killing of them was not on the level of meanness. But it was like his grandfather said, Ina, do not go any further. Ati Rosha. Do not take your anger any further. Stop here. And, you know, he didn't say, why should I want to kill those guys, you know? And I'm going to do this, this, and this. Okay, if I can't do this, I'll do this. You know, he wasn't feverishly, madly angry. But it was the nature of a Kshatriya to be very strong. And the Yakshas admired him because of his strength and his righteousness. So we will say, but how could he do something wrong? Right? No? Yes? But then that's we're examining him through the portals of our own brain and what we see around us and attributing his characteristics to him that we would or other people would have in this present circumstance in which we live. We can't do more than that, except we can hear and try to understand these impossible to understand exalted transcendental qualities that appear contradictory but are all exalted. And never imitate, by the way. Not that Johnny Tai wants to go out and kill some yakshas. Or make the prasadam line shorter. For me, I always have to, when I read these leaders, if I'm not in the right mood, if I'm in the right mood, I just honor as you would honor prasadam. But if I'm not in the right mood, that means my intelligence is sort of dominating, then all these kind of little bits of tiny doubtful things crop up. What about this? How come that? What is? And I have to note them, that that's happening to me. You know, I'm not this, the leela's not going through properly. It's getting kind of stuck. Do you understand what I mean? I have reservations. I'm not sure if I believe this. Why did they do that? They could have done this. Then I understand that at that moment I'm very much dominated by my own intelligence. And my intelligence is tiny, to say the least, to say the most, tiny. And so through my intelligence I've gone up, 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 and I'm now looking down on transcendence. Yes, and I'm trying to analyze and see if I accept it or not. Does that sound a bit absurd? Huh? You need to think about that for a bit. Okay. So tomorrow we'll discuss that some more. The day after. Yes.
So in other words, when we are listening or reading these past hours,
yeah,
we should just keep our intelligence questions aside and just read it.
No, I think that's also not so good, because what happens then is you sort of read them a little bit like fairy stories, you know, etc. Passive, read them passively. I personally prefer to observe my intelligence, the doubts of my intelligence, and turn that into a need for further illumination on the subject from some source or another, into an active concern that I could go more deeply into this. And then I find I want to read more, even in a random way. I don't mean in a systematic way, but I will get onto the Veda base. You must have a folio Veda base. And I put in words and I look for something, because that sparked my intelligence. That I don't think I'm looking at it right, but I don't know how to look at it right. And so I start excavating, trying to understand more. And then sometimes my doubtful approach in the beginning to a particular verse even will take me through a whole day of thinking about the Bhagavatam. So what appeared negative turns out to be productive. Whereas if I just pacify my intelligence and say, go ahead, you know, then I might sort of walk out, I might walk out of the room and go, okay, I've done that. And then my intelligence jumps and listens, like these young boys taking their little notes, to sit and listen like High Grima, who stole all of my Bob phones. What did you do them all? And be participatory in that. Does that make sense? It may be an eccentricity of my nature, or my level of advancement being that I have these questions, doubts, and so forth. But I want to enliven my faith in the Bhagavatam rather than just pacify my intellectual ignorance. Yes, yes. When I was in Los Angeles in 1970, when Srila Prabhupada had published Nectar of Devotion, and he gave, everyone in the temple was given a copy, and we started after lunch, a terrible time. After lunch we had a Nectar of Devotion reading. It was almost impossible to stay awake, but there we were, we were sitting, going to the temple, and we'd have this half-hour reading, and Srila Prabhupada had given specific instructions. He said, if you have any questions, read it again. Okay, so then he said, and then you still have questions, right? So he said, if you have any questions still, read it again. And if you still have any questions, read it again, 3 times. Read it before you ask the question. So a superstition arose in my heart that, you know, this was the only way that these people who are reading Nectar of Devotion and talking about it, they don't understand the proper way is to read it 3 times like this before you ask any questions. But later I came to be a little more sensible and understand that, of course, you don't understand any of the concepts that this information is based on. You're new here. You've only been chanting Hare Krishna for a few months. And even somebody from an Indian origin background may have the same thing. The subject matter is totally new to you. So if you start asking questions when everything is new to you, you won't understand the answers. You didn't understand the text. Now you ask a question and the answer comes to you and you go, that's very confusing. You'll get more and more and more confused. So read it again. So thank you. That's a very good point. And actually, if you treat the Bhagavatam like this is Krishna in Kali Yuga coming in this form to give light in darkness, it's acknowledged that it's a difficult time to live. But it's also acknowledged that it's the best time to live in another way because the light is here. And the darkness makes a contrast. It's a shame that it's dark at night. But, you know, even the light on your mobile phone appears significant in the darkness because it can help you find your keys. It's an insignificant light, just one little tiny thing. But in the dark, it becomes very prominent. So the Bhagavatam becomes very, very essential. So read it again. Read it again. And each time, you'll find something that you didn't find before. It's not an ordinary literature that once you've read it, it's a bit boring. No, it's actually much more than that. It's almost like it comes alive. Anyone who's had to prepare to give a class knows this. That you sit down and the words start to sort of almost move around on the page. Right? You've had that experience? Yeah, very powerful. So read it again. Very well said. Hi Guru, why do you have 10 mobile phones in the plastic bag on your head? Alright, I think we should let... Okay, 2 more little questions.
Can we say Bhagavad Gita also? We say about Bhagavad Gita also?
Oh yes, definitely. Bhagavad Gita is like ABC. So once you learn to read, once these boys learn to read, they forget about ABC because now they read concepts. But it's all made up of ABCs, but now they get concepts. You know, this is very good, that's bad, try this. They get instructions all through the ABC. So the ABC disappears, but it never disappears. It's the building blocks of all their education. Sukadev can remember when we were in Vrindavan and so many Nepali boys came. I don't know if it was after your time or you were just finishing. Yeah, and a whole bunch of Nepali boys came. They decided that this would fill up the guru court with students. And they came in and some of the boys were 16 or 17 years old. But they didn't understand English. And I remember one boy, and he's a big boy, and there's a little boy there too, and he's sitting in the same classroom. And I hadn't thought deeply about it, so I said to him, what are you studying? And he just looked at me a little frustrated and said, English. And he's sitting with these young students who are bouncing around studying English. And I realized, oh wow, his education is halted, right, until he understands English. Because all the concepts will be given to him in English, and he'll need to know what they mean. So the ABC, until you get your ABC, your Bhagavad Gita concepts cleared, then your further education will be impaired somewhat by the lack of this information. And if you learn Bhagavad Gita, it goes on renewing itself, increasing and renewing over and over, because it's the essence of all spiritual communication. So Bhagavad Gita will definitely working that way. Anyone else? One other question? Yes. Therefore, knowing that is a problem for everyone, therefore, I heard this wonderful, not heard, I think I read it, this lecture of Srila Prabhupada, it was in Vrindavan of all places, and he said, more or less, I know that your minds are all wandering all over the place. Krishna says, just think of me, but you're not able to do it. Therefore, Krishna speaks and says, I am the light in the sun, I am the taste in the water, I am the sound in ether. And in one place, Srila Prabhupada even said, I am the sounds in the street in Bombay. And so when I go out into the city, I can't remember because I've heard that, but I can remember that I'm not remembering, which is a kind of preliminary remembrance that I'm thinking, I can't figure out how these. Krishna is asking us, remember me here in this world first. But to do that, we have to remember him here before we remember him in this world. If we don't remember him here, we definitely won't remember him out there. But that's his material energy. So ask yourself something that you really like out there, or that you like in your life, that you really want, and your mind goes back there all the time. Try to see how that's Krishna. It's very interesting. You can sit on a bus and do this, and it's much more fun than playing with your mobile phone. And it's dynamic. It's not like Shastra is the law books, but what do we do with that? How do we turn that into something that's exciting to us? But we have to see that Krishna's here too. He's out there too. He's in the city of Melbourne. He's in someone's office, he's in somebody's room, he's everywhere. So I'm not seeing him. So I've got a challenge there. Before I can always remember him, I need to see that I'm not seeing him in the material things that are drawing me away from him, so-called. That's his energy, so he's drawing me away. So how can I reciprocate with him in that situation? All right. Yes.
Why did the Yakshas kill Dhruva's brother Uttama?
Well, he was hunting. So he'd gone out hunting because princes and kings, they like to hunt. And perhaps he had come a little too close to their kingdom, because he was up in the Himalaya mountains. And so they felt that he was dangerous, a threat, perhaps. I'm speculating now. But somehow or another, they, in their spirit, to protect themselves, they thought that they should not kill him, and they did. Good question.